Good morning. We welcome Horning Middle School students. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. The school students are here with a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the State Bar and this court. We invite students to come and hear an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, we send them material about the case that we are about to hear and in which they participate as audience members. And they may engage in activities in the school relating to the case or to the judicial system. And after this second case, a justice of this court assigned for the day meets with the students to talk with them about the procedures the court uses to accept a case, decide a case, and issue an opinion. The substantive issues of the cases is not discussed. You are welcome to join the students, whether you're a student or not, to hear the discussion of the procedures of the court. Does anyone here want a summary of the case we are about to hear? If so, raise your hand, and the marshal will give you a summary. All right, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. She is the justice with whom the students will meet today. On her left is Justice David Prosser. On his left and my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. To his left is Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our second case for the day and for our February sitting, 2013 AP 265, Mauricio Aguilar versus Husco International, Inc. Arguing on behalf of Husco is John Shack. Arguing on behalf of individuals and the union is Nathan D. Eisenberg. And Mr. Shack will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is John Schock with Quarles and Brady, and I represent the petitioner, Husco International, Inc. For 25 years, Husco's employees, the plaintiffs in this case, negotiated and agreed that they would get 20-minute unpaid meal breaks. It is also undisputed that in return for agreeing that their breaks would be unpaid, the employees received the benefit of a shorter workday, as well as other monetary benefits of the same value in other parts of their contract. Now the plaintiffs would like to have their cake and eat it too. With this lawsuit, they want to keep all of the benefits that they've already received in their contracts for agreeing that their breaks would be unpaid. But now they also want to be paid for those breaks. Based on these facts and others, Husco has asserted very strong equitable defenses, but the Court of Appeals never even considered the equities in this case because it decided on its own, without any of the parties raising the issue and without the benefit of any briefing, that Husco's purely state law defenses to the plaintiff's purely state law claim are preempted by federal law. Specifically, the Court of Appeals said that Husco's defenses are preempted under Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act because they require interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement. But a state law defense to a state law claim is not preempted by Section 301. Leaving aside the issue of whether interpretation would even be necessary, not even the plaintiffs have argued that these defenses would be preempted, and they would not be. Even if they needed to be interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement to be applied. One of the cases cited by the plaintiffs, for example, Caterpillar, Inc. versus Williams. This is cited by the plaintiffs on other issues, but it provides guidance on this issue here. In that case, the plaintiffs asserted state law claims based on individual employment contracts that they had before they entered into a collective bargaining agreement. The employer raised the defense of waiver, and the employer specifically argued that the employees had waived their rights under their individual agreements when they entered into the collective bargaining agreement, and that applying that defense required interpretation of the agreement, therefore their claims were preempted. But the court explained that that would not be the case. Raising a defense that has a federal question is not going to be sufficient for removal purposes, but the court also noted that the defendant could bring this defense in state court, this defense of preemption, on the merits. And it said that it is true that when a defense to a state claim is based on the terms of a collective bargaining agreement, the state court will have to interpret that agreement to decide whether the state claim survives. In other words, even if Husco's defenses, their state law defenses in this case, require interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement, those defenses are not preempted. If anything, the state law claim might be preempted. Now, we're not arguing that here, but certainly the defenses are not preempted, and the court should have addressed them. Similarly, there is nothing to interpret. Even if it were possible to preempt the defenses as a result of having to interpret the collective bargaining agreement, notably, the court never points to a single word or phrase in the agreement that needs to be interpreted. And the plaintiffs themselves have even taken the position in this case that you do not need to interpret the collective bargaining agreement.
If I can just interrupt for a moment. My understanding is that you want this court to say that the employees do not get any money. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
They don't get the year or year plus wage claim they assert.
That is correct, right? Your Honor.
As I read the brief, you also want that you prevail over the union. And what's
correct.
The remedy there?
The remedy there, the damage is essentially, let me back up. The claims, there are three claims.
One is
breach of contract.
Right.
Okay, under Section 301. The second
contract is the collective bargaining agreement.
Your Honor. The second claim is unjust enrichment. And the third claim is promissory estoppel. And the idea behind each of these is that the union negotiated on behalf of the plaintiffs. It negotiated and agreed to these unpaid breaks. Now, when it found this regulation, DWD 27402, the union came to Husco and said, we think that these breaks need to be paid. Husco said, we disagree, but in any event, we can go to the DWD and they can formally bless the agreement. They can issue a waiver.
Right.
And instead of doing that, instead of honoring its duty of good faith and fair dealing, which requires cooperativeness in the event of unforeseen problems, District 10 used it more as a gotcha tool. And it said, well, we'll go get a waiver with you, but we want you to give us more benefits in return first. So they tried to use this rule, this requirement that they thought they had found, to extract additional concessions when they could have easily taken the ministerial step of requesting a waiver. And so that is a breach of the agreement. And the argument is we would not be here facing these claims from the plaintiffs had the union honored
its agreement. What's your damages?
So the damages are that we are potentially going to have to pay these plaintiffs twice.
Well, suppose you don't have to pay the plaintiffs. What's your damages against the union?
If we don't have to pay the our damages are only what needs to be paid to the plaintiffs. So
okay. So if you win on the plaintiff on the employee's claim, your claim against the union drops. Is that right?
Well, I think that technically it would be there would still be liability, but there would be no damages. So effectively, yes, Your Honor, that's
okay.
Correct.
So if you should prevail against the employees, then you want to go against the union to indemnify you. contribute, whichever way you want to put it.
It's neither indemnification nor contribution. I know that that's a term that the union has used in its mm-hmm. briefs. Mm-hmm. Specifically, it is breach of contract. It's not contribution. Also, we have raised unjust enrichment. And to the extent that the contract claim does not survive, which we think it will, then promissory estoppel could also be used to enforce mm-hmm. the promise that was made and avoid an unjust result.
Can you breach an illegal contract?
It's not an illegal contract, Your Honor.
Well, if the court should say it violates the regulations or the statute, can you breach a contract that's invalid under the rules or regulation?
Well, even I just want to be clear. The agreement that the union and Husco made under the DWD's regulations, the regulatory framework, is that the union and the employer first enter into the agreement, the collective bargaining agreement. And that can contain provisions that vary from the terms of Chapter 274. At that point, once they've made the agreement, they go to the DWD and can seek waiver by the DWD of enforcement of its rule. So I don't know that it would be correct to say that it violates the rule. But even if the court were to determine that there weren't compliance with the rule, I think then we would go to I don't think you'd have a breach. I think you'd have the claim of unjust enrichment.
And is it possible to obtain retroactive waiver?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in fact, hasn't the Department of Workforce Development, is it in the record whether they have consistently or inconsistently granted waivers under circumstances like this?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, and the court may recall that this case was taken to the DWD before it was filed in state court. And the plaintiffs brought essentially the same claim. They asked the DWD to recover wages for them for these unpaid breaks. And what the DWD said was, no, we're not going to do that. Although the parties have not come and asked for a waiver, the department said that is a technical matter under 274.05, which allows the department to grant the waivers.
And I believe it also held that all other conditions for a waiver would apply except for the assent of the opposing party.
That is correct. The DWD said and found specifically that there would be no that the breaks would not be prejudicial or harmful to the employees,
and not contrary to the purpose as to why they were promulgated, the health, safety, and welfare of the workers.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. And also that in this case, the last component of 274.05 is that it would be unjust to apply the rule given the circumstances of this case. And so the department said here it would be unjust and therefore it would not seek damages, and in fact that there is substantial compliance with the regulations. And we think that interpretation of its own rules deserves controlling deference, and it controls here, and that's what the court also should find.
What exactly is the deference to? Sorry.
Very briefly.
Yes.
At the beginning of your presentation, you made reference to the benefit of the bargain that the employees received, which I think my recollection is an even 8-hour day. Is that what it was?
No, Your Honor.
I don't remember what that.
That's fine. The schedule was 8 hours 20 minutes, but it's undisputed that in the bargaining process, because we're dealing with a collectively bargained agreement, had the employees asked for pay for the breaks that they agreed would be unpaid, Husco, the way that they negotiate contracts, would have insisted upon concessions of an equal amount in return, and therefore the only reason that the employees got these benefits is because they agreed to the unpaid breaks.
And that runs to the monetary benefit that you made reference to earlier.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
The claim was made under a particular regulation to the Department of Workforce Development. And the Department of Workforce Development denied the claim, interpreted several statutes in the process, the regulation and the statutes in the process. Okay. The party that made the claim and lost could have gone to the department, could have gone to LIRC, couldn't it?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part here.
The claimant could have appealed or sought review in the Labor Industry Review Commission.
They could. I don't know if it would be to LIRC or if it would be directly to the Circuit Court under 227, but there was another avenue of appeal available, yes, which they did not take.
And they did not take. Okay. Why isn't this case, then, about the decision that was made by the Department of Workforce Development and its interpretation of the statutes?
Well, HUSCO asserts that in a lot of ways it is. For example, as we just talked about, this is the substantial compliance determination. We believe that's controlling and should determine the result here. But what the plaintiffs did is they brought their lawsuit under WSSTAT Section 10903, which I should say under Chapter 109. I think it's a different subsection. But that allows them to, once the department has made its determination, bring their lawsuit under that section. But that statutory chapter only allows them to recover wages that are actually owed to them. And so what you need to do then is go to the department regulations to determine whether under those regulations they are owed any additional wages.
My question still comes up. What, if any, deference is due to the department's determinations?
The department's interpretations of its own rule should receive the phrase is escaping
weight,
me.
Right,
it's controlling. It should be not due weight, but
great weight. That's what I'm asking you. I want to know that we're.
I don't care what the answer is.
Highest standard, the middle standard. You don't think it's the lowest standard.
The highest standard, Your Honor. It should receive great weight deference. I'm sorry, it's just escaping me. And it should control here because they're interpreting their own rules when they're making these determinations.
Counselor, the claim under Chapter 109, I disagree with you a little bit because I don't think they had to go to DWD first, and I do think the courts already decided that. But they did. But the claim under Chapter 109 relies upon a finding under DWD 274.023 that there was payment due for this shortened lunch period, correct?
That is correct.
But why aren't you arguing to us administrative issue preclusion in this case, and they don't get to argue that over again? And if they need it for their claim, why isn't that the end of the story?
Well, I think, as you pointed out, Your Honor, and I did misspeak somewhat, when the plaintiffs bring their claim after the DWD's made its determination, it affects the amount of their recovery. They could have brought it initially without awaiting the determination. But I don't think the statutes still allow them to bring the claim, but we believe that the determination made in interpreting the rules by the DWD should have controlling weight, and it's effectively precluding the claim. What it results in is there's already been a determination that there are no additional wages owed.
Right. The issue was addressed, right?
By the DWD.
Yeah.
Correct.
Let me ask. You say that the decisions of the Department of Workforce Development are entitled to great weight deference. Now, I suspect Mr. Eisenberg is going to say absolutely not. What's your rebuttal to what he's going to say?
What I think am trying to articulate is that the determinations made by the DWD in interpreting their own regulations are controlling. They are not plainly inconsistent with the language or plainly erroneous. And when this court is now asked to interpret whether the plaintiffs are owed additional wages under 274.02, that interpretation provided already in this case by the DWD should be controlling.
It's a long-standing interpretation.
Well,
we've got just a couple of letters here.
There are two issues here. One, it's a reasonable interpretation, and number two, it also is a long-standing interpretation. So let's look at 274.02 in particular. That is a regulation that was created pursuant to the DWD's authority to regulate hours of work. In fact, 274.02 is called hours of work. Chapter 274, it's within that chapter of hours of work and overtime. And what the DWD has said with respect to interpreting 27402, and has always said since it's been promulgated, is that the purpose is to determine what time should be counted as work time. And when you look at whether that rule has been satisfied, the department looks at whether the employees have received minimum wage and the other overtime requirements of the chapter have been met. And what DWD does is it has a formula. It takes all of the pay that the employees have received for that week that's in question. It then adds up all of the time worked, and in this case, that would include now the breaks that were not treated as time worked before. And it divides the wages by the amount of time worked, and that comes up with an average hourly wage. That formula has already been discussed and approved as being reasonable in the Kinert decision, which we cite. Now, there it was being used to determine specifically compliance with the overtime regulation. But it's the same formula, and it's what the DWD has done since it's been promulgated. That's also set forth in the second affidavit of Bob Anderson, which is at Petitioner's Appendix, page 193. Mr. Anderson explains that they use this as a sort of one-size-fits-all rule because they have to apply it consistently, and that they've always done it this way. And as long as, once you find that average hourly wage, as long as that is above minimum wage, there is no requirement for the department. Well, I should say, the employees are not entitled to additional wages under 27402. That's the way the DWD wrote it. That's the way that the DWD interprets it and always has and applies it every time they have one of these cases before them.
And always has. You have these formulas that you just cited. But aren't we talking about an interpretation of 27402-3? If you had to document that there has been a long-standing interpretation of that subsection, what do you have beside the affidavit?
Well, I think I want to just clarify the issue. In terms of great weight deference and a long-standing interpretation, that's if the department is interpreting a statute that it's been tasked with administering. Here we're talking about the department's interpretation of its own rule, which under Kinert, the standard there is not that it has to be long-standing interpretation, but that it's the DWD's interpretation of its own rule. And the DWD did that here, and you can see that in Mr. Anderson's affidavit, but it's also just the most reasonable interpretation. If you look at Chapter 274, and in particular, Sub 3 of 27402, it says the employer shall pay all employees for on-duty meal periods, which are to be counted as work time. The next section down, 27403, talks about paying overtime at 1.5 times the regular rate of pay. So the department uses different phrases when it wants to refer to different types of payment. If it wanted to say regular rate of pay, it clearly knew how to do that and could have. Here it just said shall pay. And what Mr. Anderson has explained and what the DWD, it's an undisputed fact that what the DWD does is that once they determine the average hourly wage, the only consideration is whether that meets the minimum wage requirement and whether also the overtime pay regulations have been satisfied.
With regard to a deference analysis, is there any difference between the opinion of an employee of an agency and an agency's opinion?
I don't know what that means specifically, but in this case, we have the opinion of Mr. Anderson. Well, first of all, we have the agency's determination with respect to substantial compliance.
In part, I'm trying to follow up on Justice Prosser's line of inquiry when he asked, show me the longstanding interpretation, of course, which is indicia of a level of deference. Is there only an interpretation of an employee here as opposed to an agency's interpretation?
And again, I think when we're talking about the longstanding interpretation, that is dealing with if the agency is interpreting a statute that it administers. Here we're talking about the rule, which does not require that. But in any event, With respect to substantial compliance, the department itself made that determination. With respect to the formula that is used to determine whether there is any additional wage owed under 274.03, what we have is the undisputed fact provided by Mr. Anderson in his affidavit, who was the was at the department for 34 years, was the director of the Labor Standards Bureau at the time this case was decided, and also was the individual at the agency who confirmed the decision.
Is that individual, is that employee's interpretation of the regulation the same as the agency's interpretation of the regulation?
Our position would be that it is. There's really no reason to make a distinction, particularly given his role in this case.
And well, is he an expert witness? Is he being paid to testify on behalf of the company?
No, Your Honor. In fact, in his affidavits, both of them, I believe, it's made very clear that Mr. Anderson was not asked to serve as an expert. He was not paid as an expert by Husco. He donated his time to provide his guidance to the court.
And does his affidavit, which is quite lengthy, state the basis for his saying how long this has been the interpretation?
Yes, it explains the amount of time that he's been at the agency, in what position, that he's employed this as he was there, both as an investigator and as the director of the Labor Standards Bureau.
And everybody else employed it that way?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
That everyone else in the agency did what he did?
I think what he says is that this is the way the agency does it and has always done it.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying that when the agency is interpreting its own rule, it's entitled to X deference, but when the agency is interpreting a statute, you owe it certain deference depending on how long standing it has been doing so?
Yes, I think there are two standards. In particular, if you look at the Kinert decision, which we've cited, it talks about interpreting the statutory language that the department has been tasked with administering. And there you can have either due weight deference or you can have great weight deference, part of it depending upon whether it's a longstanding interpretation.
Yeah, but
when it comes to the rule, it's controlling in any event.
Isn't there another rule that says, as to standard of review, that where an agency is determining its own powers, you don't give it any deference?
Well, they're not determining their own powers here. What they're determining is whether, under their rule, the language entitles the employees to any additional wages. And that determination is controlling. And they did that.
Go ahead. You hadn't finished.
I was just going to say, and they did that, with respect to both substantial compliance, which is one reason why the employees are not entitled to any additional wages, and they also did that with respect to interpreting 274.03 and whether any additional wage is owed under that particular rule.
Counsel, I want to come at this a little different approach. My understanding is you're asking for summary judgment. My understanding is that the circuit court didn't give summary judgment to either side. Did the court find there were genuine issues of material fact, or why did the court refuse summary judgment to both sides?
I think the best way to summarize that, Your Honor, is that the circuit court – oh, I'm sorry. I see that my red light is on.
You may answer.
The circuit court said that he agreed with Husco that the employees were able under the regulations to waive their right to additional pay. What he said he thought there was a material issue of fact on was whether each employee had waived its right. And that's why he denied summary judgment. Now, Husco agrees with the circuit court in the sense that they can waive their right. This is an agreement that can be made in the very first instance between the district, between the union and Husco. But when it comes to whether each employee waived their right, that's not material. That would take the collective out of collective bargaining. The union, and we've cited case law in our briefs, has the authority to waive the rights on behalf of the employees. And in fact, if that weren't the case, we would have chaos in our hands every time the employees disagreed with what their union had agreed to. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, and we haven't gotten to preemption yet. Eisenberg.
Good
represent both the union and the employees?
That's correct, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Nathan Eisenberg. I represent the employee plaintiffs in this case, led by lead plaintiff Mauricio Aguiar. I also represent the employees' union, International Association of Machinists District 10. Husco's arguments concerning the employees' claims in this case are directly contrary to two cases. First of all, this court's decision in German versus Department of Transportation from 2000, and secondly, the Seventh Circuit's decision in Sporley versus Kraft Foods. In German, this court held that DWD 274.02 provides that employees are entitled to be paid for all break periods of less than 30 minutes at their regular rate of pay. The wage claim in that case and in this case are identical. Namely, the plaintiffs are seeking to recover wages for unpaid breaks of less than 30 minutes at their regular rate of pay. Husco's arguments that employees can be paid at $0 an hour or that wage rates can be averaged are directly contrary to this court's holding in German. In that case, the court specifically stated that Wisconsin Statute 109.03 subsection 5 allows an employee to bring a private cause of action for the full amount of wages due. We believe the statute contemplates a situation where the issue is not that the employees have never received a paycheck, but that they seek to obtain the full amount of wages due to them. So German is very clear on this point, and it's directly contrary to the position that Husco is taking in this case. So being able to average wages or pay them at $0 an hour would utterly defeat the purpose of the regulation at issue. And that was the square holding in German.
But wouldn't the converse be true, counsel, that if it was going to be enforced mechanically, that it would defeat the purpose of the collective bargaining agreement here? The briefs say, your opposing counsel represents, and I assume you agree, that and I can't imagine the union entering into a collective bargaining agreement like this unless it saw a benefit to do so.
Well, that has really two components to it. And that's the second case that I just mentioned, which is Sporley versus Kraft Foods. And in that case, which also involved the DWD regulation, the Seventh Circuit specifically found that what Wisconsin requires is that the collective bargaining agreement be ignored to the extent that it sets lower wages than required by Wisconsin law. So under Sporley, if there is an illegal contract provision, and the contract provision in this case was very clearly contrary to the regulation, then that provision must be ignored.
Didn't DWD call this a technical violation?
I think if you actually look at what the DWD did, it actually said that this was a violation of 274.
I think they said but it did say technical violation, one of a kind which is routinely waived by the department, perhaps out of understanding that parties are going to be free to enter into their own agreements for their own purposes, which they're going to see as fair in their particular situation. I guess I do wonder, and your opposing counsel used the phrase in his opening statement, or his opening presentation, why isn't this a case of your clients wanting to have their cake and eat it too? They got the benefit of the bargain, and now they're coming back for the payment of the 20 minutes that they gave up in exchange for other benefits.
Well, again, I think the law is clear on this, and we're looking at the federal law governing collective bargaining agreements, right? In order for there to be a waiver of a mandatory subject of bargaining under the National Labor Relations Act, that waiver must be clear, unmistakable, and intentional.
So where does the Department of Workforce Development enter into your reasoning? Because they say all of the preconditions for retroactive waiver are met here. And so what they say just doesn't matter?
Well, I think you need to go back to look at the letters that the DWD wrote and that Mr. Anderson wrote while he was actually at the agency rather than the litigation affidavit solicited by Husco after the fact. If you go back and you look at Mr. Anderson's statements, and there's a letter that Mr. Anderson wrote on September 17, 2007, which is contained in Petitioner's Appendix on page 189. And in that letter, Mr. Anderson specifically wrote two things. One, the department in its initial determination included that Husco had violated DWD 274.02 subsection 3 by not paying workers for on-duty meal period times of less than 30 minutes in duration. And then later in the letter, he had a cease and desist order, and he said that if Husco continues to use this 20-minute break, the break will count as work time at the employee's normal rate of pay. So that's what he put in the letter, and he was very explicit about those points. What Husco is doing now is, after the fact, they've solicited an affidavit from Mr. Anderson after he's no longer employed by the agency or within its control. And in his litigation affidavit, which counsel referenced a number of times, Mr. Anderson is saying things that are directly contrary to those two points. Namely, now Mr. Anderson is saying that you don't need to pay them at their regular rate of pay. He's saying that you could pay them at $0 an hour. He has this argument that you could average out wage rates, despite the fact that those wages are specifically set forth in the collective bargaining agreement. So, again, you need to go back to the issues about interpretation of a collective bargaining agreement.
Wouldn't there always be a breach of that if you're having a reverse waiver?
I don't know if I understand the question.
What would have to be waived if something wasn't breached?
Well, the issue of waiver, how the federal law deals with waiver of a mandatory subject of bargaining is that it has to be explicit. And that's actually also...
Okay. That I understand.
Okay.
But on these, where they go back in time, do you think they can do that, go back in time and have sort of this waiver after the fact?
No, I don't believe you can retroactively go back and take wages that would have been required under state law. And I don't think the record really supports that assertion either.
I guess it started with Justice Gableman's initial question when he was talking as if it's something that DWD can do, that from time to time they go back and determine that there was or that they would have accepted waiver kind of after the fact. Let's say the union goes back and says we want this to be deemed a waiver. You say that never happens? That can't happen?
I don't believe it can happen. I think that once the employees do the work and earn the wages, they're entitled to those wages. And I think there would be a real problem in going back 2 years and saying all these wages have been have effectively evaporated. The state law requires that those wages be paid at the regular rate of pay, and that's what should have happened here.
Okay. So when the department determined that they would have accepted a waiver, they were just acting arbitrarily and capriciously and had no basis for doing that?
Well, I think the places where the agent, where you're saying that the agency said that, weren't actually part of the agency record. You're referring to a number of affidavits that were solicited from agency personnel, some of which occurred after those people left the agency.
I hear what you're saying. I'm just asking, do you think that can happen, or is that an impossibility?
The retroactive waivers?
Yeah.
I think it is, but I also think that's besides the point because there never was a retroactive waiver in this case.
Okay. So you think, when you said I think it is, you mean to say there can be retroactive waiver?
Yeah, I don't think you can have a retroactive waiver. But again, and in this case, there never was a waiver. There was never a waiver applied for. There was never a waiver granted.
Counsel, I want to talk to you a little bit about German, and I'm going to talk to you about the similar question that I asked opposing counsel. I read German perhaps a little bit differently than you did, and if I'm off on my facts or whatever, please feel free to correct me. My understanding is the question, there were two questions in German. One was whether you could bring a Chapter 109 claim for wages without first going to DWD. And the other one was whether the state, because these involved state patrol folks that were asking for additional wages, whether the state had waived sovereign immunity, correct?
Those are some of the issues in the case.
Okay. Well, we may, if there's more, I'm sure you and I will get to that.
Let me phrase the question, okay?
My understanding is that there was never a proceeding before DWD in German, so there was no initial determination made under 274.02 sub 3 whether wages were due or not, correct?
I think that's correct from the facts of that case.
Right.
Although German does talk about these parallel proceedings.
It talks about not having to go before DWD before you bring a Chapter 109 proceeding, because that was the question that was presented, because there was no proceeding in DWD. My concern here is similar to what I voiced to opposing counsel. DWD was proceeded before, however, and there was a determination made that no wages were due under 274.02 parent 3 parent 4 particular reasons, and if there had been a wage due, it would have been at a 0.00. So for all practical purposes, they found, number one, the shortened period didn't interfere with health or safety of the employees, and that in this case, failure to seek a waiver was just a technical violation. Is that right, or am I off on those facts?
I think you're, again, confusing some of the facts that are contained in the sort of post hoc litigation affidavits and the things that the agency actually determined.
Okay. Tell me where.
The agency has prosecutorial discretion whether or not to pursue wages on behalf of employees. So when employees file a wage claim through the DWD process, the DWD has the ability to make a decision whether or not it's going to pursue those wage claims.
Right.
And the record in front of the DWD reflects that. Again, there's a letter from the DWD on October 8, 2007, where the DWD specifically says if the union believes it's entitled to compensation for these unpaid meal break periods, the union, on behalf of its members, can bring a lawsuit against Husco in civil court. So the DWD specifically contemplated the situation.
They did contemplate a particular situation, but there is also a letter, July 16, 2007, that I'm looking at, and it says that, as such, it's my decision that Keekaber is not entitled to payment of additional compensation that he's seeking at this time. And this was the compensation under 274.22 sub 3, correct?
Right.
Okay, so that determination was made. I didn't see in the record that the determination made here was submitted to anyone, like the circuit court. There was no appeal of this decision to the circuit court or any further action taken on this particular decision, right?
That's right, because the employees had the right to initiate the case.
Okay, but why isn't that issue preclusion? That you have the right to initiate a lawsuit under Chapter 109, which German said you had without a DWD action. But here you did take that first step. So why isn't there a concern with issue preclusion by the earlier decision made on these same facts?
Well, again, because the earlier decisions by the DWD were a decision that they were not going to go after and seek the wages.
That's not what I read to you. I'm reading right out of their decision. Right. And that's not that they were not going to go after. It said that it is my decision that Keekaber is not entitled to payment of the additional compensation he is seeking for this time. So it may be that they weren't interested in going after him, sure, but they weren't interested because they didn't think anything was due. And my concern is issue preclusion, which lies under administrative law, just like it lies everywhere else, if it's properly before the court. Why shouldn't I look at this as issue preclusion and this issue has already been determined, so there's nothing due?
Well, because also the structure of Chapter 109, and I think counsel mentioned the penalty provisions in Chapter 109.
Say it again.
That there's a provision in there that enhances the penalties if you complete the DWD process, that a plaintiff that brings a claim is entitled to more damages after completing the DWD process. Now, that structure of the statute contemplates that giving the DWD the opportunity to resolve the claim as part of its prosecutorial discretion is included in the scheme. But it also gives those employees the right, if they disagree with that, to go to court and to bring a case in the first instance.
So you're saying there's no issue of preclusion because it's a de novo determination. Is that what you're saying?
I think that is what I'm saying.
Okay. Tell me the statute that you just referred to, or is it part of DWD? I'm looking at Chapter 109, so...
While you're looking it up, maybe you can do two things at once. Was issue preclusion ever argued here?
Say that again.
Was issue preclusion ever argued here?
No.
Okay.
I think when you talk about great weight deference, what you're saying is the decision of the DWD is conclusive. So you can put a number of labels on it.
It doesn't say it's conclusive. It determines what's the most reasonable interpretation.
You want to go ahead and see if you can find the answer to my question?
Chapter 109, subsection 11, where it's talking about the penalties.
Okay. Civil penalties, number two, is that what you're looking at?
That's
or administrative
where I
penalties?
I was looking.
Okay.
And subsection A talks about a situation where there's been a wage claim brought before the DWD. Maybe I have that backwards. One of the sections talks about if you go straight to court, and one of the sections talks about if you go through the DWD.
Well, that talks about a wage claim.
So B says, in a wage claim action that has commenced after the department has completed its investigation.
Okay.
And then skipping to the end, increased wages of not more than 100% of the amount those wages due. So that scheme specifically contemplates the actions that the plaintiffs took in this case.
Okay, I'll read it and think about it. Thank you for pointing that out.
You know, counsel, I'd like to go back to some questions that Justice Ziegler asked you, which were based on questions that I had asked you, which were based on questions I had asked your opposing counsel. Now, it's going to be convenient for you because I, too, am looking at a letter dated July 16th, 2007, the one that Justice Rogensack made reference to just a few minutes ago. And in response to my questions in regard to the DWD finding about a technical violation and in regard to retroactive modifications, you told me that that was the product of former Department of Workforce Development employees who had left, and then you said they solicited, your opposing counsel solicited affidavits. Now, do you agree with my characterization of our conversation?
I think the letters that you're referring to, and I think there's three of these letters. There's the July letter, there's the September letter, there's the October letter. Those are what was actually in the agency.
Sure.
The opinions after that, these affidavits that were
solicited. Yeah, but when I asked you those questions, you told me they were the product of the after the employment letters that your opposing counsel had solicited. And I think there are some very important parts in this July 16 letter. It is not disputed that the parties failed to request a waiver from the department under 27405. However, that is a technical violation of the code. Now, this is written on Department of Workforce Development letterhead. I assume the author was still employed at that time. The application of the waiver is required in order for the department to determine if a waiver or modification, et cetera, you know what it says. In this case, the last paragraph on the first page, it must be assumed that the employees' collective bargaining representatives are looking out for the best interests of their membership. As such, it is reasonable to assume that the employees' union would not have entered into the lunch period agreement that jeopardized a lunch period agreement that jeopardized the life, health, safety, or welfare of those members. Furthermore, the department does find that it would be unjust if Husco were to be required to pay for a 20-minute lunch period when the complainant was allowed the benefits of a reduced workday as part of the bargaining process. And very briefly, second to last sentence, based on my review of this matter, the factors required to approve a waiver or modification, which by date of this letter would by definition have had to have been retroactive, are present in the facts of this case. So how does that square with your prior answer that all of the findings about a technical violation and retroactive modification were the product of solicited affidavits from former employees?
Well, because after that letter, Mr. Anderson followed it up with the second letter and the third letter.
But this is
Let me point out
that the author of this letter is a Steve Leash or Leash, L, I can't read it, L-A-E-S-C-H. So what?
Well, and so the second and third letters are appeals of that decision. But let me also point out another thing. And the paragraph that you cited.
So how does that square with your response to Justice Ziegler that retroactive modifications are not permitted by the DWD?
Well, let me put it this way.
I get the feeling you disagree. You have a personal disagreement.
It's not a personal disagreement. It's a legal disagreement.
Okay.
And that's because this paragraph that you just cited, where the DWD tries to insert itself in a collective bargaining agreement for the purpose of interpreting a collective bargaining agreement, is well beyond the scope of the DWD's authority. And that's because interpretation of collective bargaining agreements arise solely under federal law. And the DWD doesn't have the ability to go into the collective bargaining agreement and start interpreting those various provisions.
Did you argue that in front of the Court of Appeals?
Absolutely.
And they agreed with you?
Yes. The Court of Appeals, actually, they had a very well-reasoned decision how once you go into the collective bargaining agreement and you start weighing the competing provisions of the collective bargaining agreement, provisions dealing with vacation, provision dealing with breaks, provision dealing with wages, that's 301. That is preempted under 301 of the National Labor Relations Act. The DWD doesn't have the authority to go in and interpret those provisions. And that's very clear under U.S. Supreme Court case law.
Counselor, I have a question going back to our little discussion before. Are you familiar with Hubbard versus Messner, M-E-S-S-E-R? It's at 203 Wisconsin 145. According to the headnote, and I haven't read it, so I'm asking you because you're my expert, it says that subsection 2B, which you referred to me before, is applicable only when DWD has found that more wages are due. So they didn't find other wages were due here, so I'm wondering, is this section really something we should be considering?
Well, I think the increased penalties are definitely something that's going to be included in this case.
With respect to the individual case,
you've kind of stumped me because that's not a case that's included in the briefing.
Yeah. Well, I'm just reading the headnotes off of the statute you referred to me, and it says, you know, that this section may be applied only when wages are due and unpaid at the time that an enforcement action is sought under Chapter 109. So it does perceive going to DWD first, but then seeking enforcement of DWD's order through Chapter 109 because there are extra penalties.
USCO has never paid the wages, Your Honor.
No, but there was none ordered by DWD either, so you couldn't get into that section to start
but
with.
But at the time the lawsuit was commenced, Husco has still not paid the wages. Husco has never paid the wages for the break periods of less than 30 minutes.
Okay, but this talks about, well, I won't repeat it to you. You can read it, and I will read it when we both have more time.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's fair enough.
Counsel, I think you started your presentation by citing the German case and the Sporley case. Those cases discussed Chapter 109, did they?
German specifically discussed both Chapter 109 and the DWD regulation that are at issue in this case. So
274?
Yes. The exact provision about breaks of less than 30 minutes is exactly discussed in the German case.
That was my question.
I think.
About the Court of Appeals decision, is there anything you would have us change, or would you be satisfied with us just adopting everything in the Court of Appeals decision?
Well, that's a loaded question. I, of course, the Court of Appeals ruled in favor of both the plaintiffs and of District 10, so it's very hard to disagree with the decision that we were the prevailing party on all of those claims. I think that the Court of Appeals, when it was addressing the third-party complaint, really, Alice Chalmers is a very key case. It's not the only federal preemption doctrine that's implicated here. Husco tries to pivot at several places to avoid the federal preemption of national labor law. And I think really one of the areas that's really a little lacking is the discussion of Garmin preemption. And Garmin preemption talks about conduct. So when Husco is making complaints that the union should have engaged in certain type of conduct, they should have bargained over a waiver, they should have written a waiver, they shouldn't have helped the employees, these are all issues that are squarely in Garmin preemption. And Garmin says that those claims can exclusively be brought before the National Labor Relations Act and that both state and federal courts cannot consider those claims. I would call the court's attention to a case that's cited in our brief, which is Gerhardsen versus Gopher News, which is an Eighth Circuit decision, which I think really highlights some of the issues in this case. And in that case, the Eighth Circuit specifically noted that there is no 301 claim to address contract invalidity. Instead,
what was your word after contract invalidity? To address contract.
There is no 301 claim for that issue.
Contract invalidity.
Instead, that claim concerns the duty to bargain. And the duty to bargain is an unfair labor practice. It's an unfair labor practice. It can solely be brought before the National Labor Relations Board. So I think between Husco only tries to articulate one of its claims against District 10 in the scope of 301, and that's the claim that I think Gopher News deals with, which is the contract invalidity. You cannot use 301 to give meaning and effect to an illegal contract provision. And Husco really makes no argument trying to recast any of its other claims against District 10 as federal 301 claims. And it never, ever addresses Garmin preemption at all. It also doesn't address the other lines of cases. I think we were talking a little bit about waiver earlier, and there's a very clear line of federal cases that talk about when you submit a case to arbitration, and the issue of waiver was submitted to a labor arbitration in this case, and Husco specifically lost that issue. So under the other line of cases, the Steelworkers Trilogy, which is three U.S. Supreme Court cases that are just collectively referred to as that way, and in those cases where the parties to a collective bargaining agreement have agreed to submit their disputes over contract interpretation to an arbitrator, the courts have no business considering whether there's equity in that claim. And that's the American Manufacturing case as part of that trilogy. And in this case, that issue about waiver, about whether or not a waiver should have been granted, whether or not District 10 should have been forced to sign a waiver, was specifically addressed in a labor arbitration in November 2008. And that's included in our appendix at page 232. So Husco hasn't addressed Garmin. It hasn't addressed the Steelworkers Trilogy. And these cases are really foreclose any of their third-party complaints. And as the Court of Appeals really effectively pointed out, once Husco starts to try to get into the collective bargaining agreement, they're also preempted under 301 under the Alice Chalmers decision.
And most of your preemption arguments lie against claims against the union, correct?
That's true, but if you look at the way that the equitable defenses to the plaintiff's claims are being articulated, those are all claims that require interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement. For each of its equitable defenses, Husco is articulating in those in a way that talk about harmonizing the different provisions of the collective bargaining agreement, interpreting the collective bargaining agreement. And some of them aren't really aimed at the plaintiffs at all. They're, again, aimed at the union. So when you're talking about things like estoppel, that's really that the union was stopped from bringing the claims. And when you're talking about waiver, that's really a claim that the union waived this. And they, again, they repeatedly are trying to mix the interests of the plaintiffs with the interests of the union. And those are two separate parties with two separate interests. And those are things that are specifically discussed and addressed in the Barentine decision.
Now, you don't talk much about and haven't been asked questions much about the standard that would be owed, if any, to the decision on the DWD decision on the interpretation of 274.02 sub 3. What's your best argument that we should just ignore that and not apply some level of deference to it?
The DWD didn't interpret the regulation. They made a decision not to prosecute wage claims in this case. And to the extent that they did talk about the regulations, they found that there was a violation. And that's why the appeal of the initial determination specifically says there is a violation of the DWD regulation. And that's what's contained in the actual record.
So if the employees win in this case and they get their amounts that are back due, then the dispute becomes between Husco and the union, right?
Well,
and Husco and the union will duke out who owes what because they had a mutual mistake. Presumably neither side knew what they were doing when they negotiated this 20-minute break, right?
Well, it's so undisputed that neither party knew that that provision violated the law.
So it was a mutual mistake, let's just say. So then the issue would be between Husco and you as to who pays what portion of what was paid to the employees. Is that how you see this working out?
Well, I don't think there is any claim that Husco can bring against the union.
Why not?
That's preempted under one of the four doctrines that we discuss in our brief. There can be no claim by Husco against the union to contribute to this claim. It can't exist.
It can't exist in state court. Can it exist in federal court?
I think Husco has cited some very broad language talking about the duty of good faith and fair dealing. I think that would be very difficult to reconcile with the duty to bargain in good faith under the National Labor Relations Act, and I think that's an issue that's really Garmin preemption. If they wanted to bring that claim would have needed to have been brought as a failure to bargain in good faith under the National Labor Relations Act, and that's what Garmin preemption addresses. So there may be a claim for that, but they would have needed to bring it before the National Labor Relations Board, which has exclusive jurisdiction over those claims. Neither the state nor the federal courts would have jurisdiction to hear a claim like that.
Would there have been a time limit for that, or could they still bring that?
There was a 6-month time limit, Your Honor.
Mr. Eisenberg, a little bit ago you referred us to your appendix at 232. It constitutes 4 pages of a testimony provided by Mr. Ho, H-O. And that's testimony.
I think you're referring to the arbitration decision?
Yes, sir.
And there are pages from the arbitration transcript,
right,
which starts at 232, and immediately following those pages in the appendix is the decision of arbitrator Herman Terosian. So they all go in order, and they follow through. And Mr. Terosian specifically said that the parties would not have knowingly agreed to an illegal provision, so it is speculative to what the parties would have ultimately agreed to given the various options available. And
you're quoting from something. Can you tell me what?
I believe it's on page 246.
Okay. 246?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
So I see my time is up.
Is your argument that this concept of good faith and fair dealing, which is after the collective bargaining agreement has been executed, seems to me your argument is saying it really goes to good faith and fair dealing in determining the collective bargaining agreement, and therefore that's 301.
Well, again, if you're talking about interpreting the collective bargaining agreement, that's the 301 claim. Husco is not trying to interpret language in the collective bargaining agreement that said that District 10 needed to sign a waiver. There is no language like that.
Mm-hmm.
What they're trying to say is that under the duty of good faith and fair dealing, that the union would have had to do things beyond that. And that's why I'm saying that's really claims about conduct following contract invalidity rather than a claim of contract under 301. So that's why I say that's really an issue that's preempted under Garmin.
Could I ask you, in the September 17th letter that's signed by Mr. Anderson, I believe, is that history correct in there going back to 1968?
Where does it say?
Fourth paragraph.
I don't believe it goes back to 1968. I think it goes back to the 1980s.
He's talking about 39 years here.
I do believe it was 39 years, Your Honor.
Well, you don't have 39 years since 1983, I don't believe.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
Which is right?
I believe that there was some 30-year history of this. The date is eluding me at the moment.
The previous letter, too, in the second paragraph references, it goes back to the late 60s. Mr. Leach's letter.
30-year history of what? Not paying for
the agreement
minutes.
With the employees under the union contract.
Yeah, that there was an illegal contract provision for that duration.
Well, if it's all very technical, how come the DWD didn't say it's all technical about whether you ask for a waiver or we give you a waiver and we're giving you a waiver? They didn't say that, did they?
No. They specifically said there was no waiver.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Schock.
If I may address a couple of, or clarify a couple of issues. First of all, with respect to counsel's argument that HUSCO is claiming we need to interpret the agreement and harmonize provisions, that is absolutely not what HUSCO has been arguing. In fact, it's the opposite. HUSCO has argued consistently from day one. The agreement is very clear. The breaks are unpaid. There's no need to interpret the agreement to understand that they're unpaid. And in fact, in my opening remarks, I pointed to the motion to remand that the plaintiffs themselves filed, saying when they wanted to avoid this case being in federal court, it was in their interest to say there was no need to interpret this agreement. And they said, we agree with HUSCO. The breaks are unpaid. There's no need for the court to interpret the agreement when the parties agree as to its meaning. So I want to be very clear. There is no need to interpret the agreement. That is not HUSCO's argument. And when it suited them, the plaintiffs agreed with that. And again, even if coming back to this issue of retroactive waiver, as Justice Gableman pointed out, I think exactly what the DWD did in its decision is effectively granting a retroactive waiver. And Rule 274.05 specifically says the department can grant a waiver as the circumstances of the case may require. And in this case, not only in the DWD's decision did they do that, but we also have Mr. Anderson's affidavit, which explains that would be appropriate. And we also submitted the affidavit, and it's undisputed, that Howard Bernstein, the acting general counsel of DWD, I think even today, and certainly at the time of his affidavit, said that he also would have granted a retroactive waiver because, in his words, it certainly would have been appropriate in this case.
Even though no one asked for it?
It was not asked for only because the plaintiffs refused to do so. But the department explained that's the technical part of it, and substantial compliance comes down to did you meet the spirit of the rule, and that's what happened here.
Your argument is you can force waiver.
It's not forced.
DWD can force waiver.
No, Your Honor, respectfully. The argument is HUSCO would not be able to go to the DWD and ask for this had the plaintiffs not already requested it, and had they not been represented by a labor organization in this case. The chapter allows, where there is a labor organization protecting the rights of the employees, it allows flexibility for those parties to agree. And in this case, they agreed.
And that seems to be tacitly recognized, if not expressly, by the arbitrator. On page 15, respondents, appendix 247, the union's proposed remedy is purely speculative. It is equally feasible that after all is said and done, the parties might agree to request a waiver since a 20-minute unpaid break was something acceptable to both parties for some 25 years. Under the circumstances, a 15-minute per-shift monetary award would be a windfall to the employees. The added 15 minutes of monetary payment is not something that one can reasonably assume would have likely resulted had good faith negotiations continued. And so the award was to make everybody go back and negotiate to make the waiver retroactive, potentially.
And, Your Honor, if I might point out, with respect to that arbitration decision, I think the plaintiffs are arguing too much here. It's true that he said, I don't know what you would have done had you gone back to that point in time. Now, that doesn't matter with respect to a breach of contract claim, because the point is you already have made the contract. You should honor it, and you can do that. But what the arbitrator also, in the section you're referencing, he was pointing out that the union is seeking a retroactive monetary remedy to compensate its employees. They're seeking wages. And what, what the arbitrator said was, I'm not giving you wages. So if they want this to be a binding decision.
And the basis of that denial was not that it was outside of the purview or authority of the agency. It was based on the speculative nature of the award.
That is correct. So if they want the arbitration decision to control here, I think that arbitration decision also clearly says they're not entitled to wages either. But with respect to that decision, I also want to be clear that that was with respect to Husco's decision later, after the not during the class period, but at the end of the class period, to go to a 30-minute unpaid break. The issue there was whether Husco had breached, not whether the District 10 had breached.
30-minute unpaid or paid?
Ultimately, they went to a 30-minute unpaid break. And so the question was not even before the arbitrator as to whether it would be a breach for District 10 to not seek a waiver.
Oh, right.
I'm sorry. I see my time is up. If I may, just briefly.
Just very briefly, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. What I think I'd like to leave the court with is simply a reminder that the plaintiffs in this case have received everything that they bargained for. They're getting everything that they expected. They want now this court to provide them with a statutory windfall, which even they at times have conceded would not be fair. The only fair and appropriate result in this case is to remand it with instructions to enter summary judgment in Husco's favor. Thank you.
You didn't raise the concept collateral estoppel here, whatever we call it now. You did not raise collateral estoppel. That is, they're estopped because they already dealt with this at the DWD.
But what we did, Your Honor, was we argued that determination is controlling. And we do argue specifically, and maybe that's one point that needs to be clarified. With respect to the plaintiff's claims, there are four defenses. Unjust enrichment, equitable estoppel, in other words, they've agreed no wages are owed, and therefore they can't now claim that they are. Waiver, and also that they failed to mitigate their damages by refusing to seek a waiver that would have been granted.
I got it. Not relying on the DWD. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to, on behalf of the court, thank both counsel for their briefs and for their oral argument today on an issue that does not frequently come to this court, and trying to clarify for the court the issues of preemption as well as ordinary contract action. Issues of, as you outlined most recently, Mr. Schock, in your closing statement. That concludes our hearing on 2013 AP 265, Aguilar versus Hosco International Law. It is now 12:45. The court will reconvene with a very short lunch break at 1:30 to hear the third argument. And Justice Ziegler will discuss these procedural issues with those students who can still remain. Who are they, Marshall? Okay. Not the students who came earlier. All right. Thank you. The middle school students shall remain in the courtroom. We are in recess.